The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to The Home Show here on News Talk. I'm Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, it's time to get working on our summer garden before the sun reconsiders. The luxury villa that Berlin's government can't give away. Do you want it? The million-pound idea that began in a skip. And Jennifer Sheehan has been to the interiors trade show, Salon de Mobile in Milan. She'll be filling us in on the latest styles and trends on the way to Ireland. If you'd like to get involved in the show today, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100, and you can listen back to any elements of the show, which will be up in podcast on the News Talk app, which is powered by Go Loud. Now, estate agents always have a good knowledge of what makes or breaks a house sale, whether it's, you know, untidy or it's dirty inside or maybe a dreadful taste in interiors, perhaps noisy traffic outside, or it's in a rundown neighbourhood. And look, they might recommend dropping the price to counteract whatever it is. But what if I told you there's a huge villa north of Berlin which can't be given away for free? We'll be finding out all about that later on and why not. But I'd love to hear from you today. What would turn off buying a house for you? What one single thing is an absolutely red line for you? What wouldn't you like? For me, do you know, I think it's a north-facing garden, but that's only a little thing. But let me know, 53106, if you want to get in touch, and thehomeshow@newstalk.com on email, and you're very welcome along to the show. Now, we are thankfully starting to see some heat and a little bit of sunshine as summer tentatively approaches. And if that means we should be busy in the gardens, well, there is no time like the present. So what should we be getting done as the season approaches? Well, Peter Dowdall is a garden designer and a friend of The Home Show. He's been on many times before and joins me again. Peter, you're very welcome back to The Home Show.
Thank you, Sinead. I love the way you tentatively describe the weather. It's kind of, we're itching back out again.
Listen, we never know. So we have to plan for everything. And such is the life of an Irish gardener. Now, my plants, I know, love nothing more than brilliant sunshine followed by pouring rain. But we had that a little bit during the week where we had heavy showers and then the sun came out and it was quite hot. But how can we be sure of a splash of colour in the coming months?
Yeah, as you say, we've seen glimpses of what possibly lies ahead, and hopefully lies ahead a spell of fine weather. But the best way to get colour now, whether it feels like it or not, we're in the second half of May, and the best way to inject colour into the garden is old-fashioned bedding plants, patio plants and bedding plants, just to get that short, sharp shock of colour in with, you know, annual plants which fill up our hanging baskets and window boxes and containers and things like that. They really are a foolproof way of bringing colour into the garden right now, Sinead.
Indeed, and they are the little ones, from pansies to kind of geraniums and marigolds and all that kind of thing, that you can find very cheaply, it must be said, in most garden centres. And I always worry a little bit about whether you're buying them, whether that's their peak and then they'll be gone in a couple of weeks. Or, like, at what stage? Should it just be as they're budding, or do you go for them in full flower?
Do you know, you're asking the right question at the right time, which I love, because if you go to your local garden centre now and get them, they'll certainly be well before peaking, if you know what I mean. You're getting them early in the season now. In fact, I was only in the garden centre myself yesterday picking up a few bits, and you can see the potential in them. The root ball hasn't filled the pot yet. They haven't become pot bound. There's a bit of colour on them, but not too much. So now is the time to get them. And in answer to your question, later, if it's later in the year, yeah, don't get the ones that are absolutely look like they're giving of their best. Look for ones that look like they have more to give. And you correctly mentioned there, Sinead, the price. I mean, plants like these, they're cheap as chips, really. You go into a garden centre, you know, and spend 20, 30, 40 euros. You have a lot to show for it when it comes to bedding plants. I can't think of too many other shops that you can say the same of anymore.
But buying plants for
colour, it really is good value.
Okay, now we still love a hanging basket, and I have one left in my garden, which my husband tends, and they can just give a lovely kind of a trailing plant, which can be lovely just to provide something a little bit different. I've hung mine on my shed to kind of distract from the shed. What are the best trailing plants to put in, Peter, into those?
And you're right, they do. They bring the kind of interest in the garden up. They kind of divert the eye up. And as you say, distract from something you might not necessarily want to be looking at. And there's lots that you can put in for trailing. But what's very important here is that we look and only use plants that are pollinator friendly. So in other words, they're kind of ecologically beneficial. Do you know what I mean? And you might think, or one might think that, oh, planting any plant is going to help. But it's not necessarily the case, because an awful lot of these summer bedding and trailing plants for hanging baskets have been so intensively hybridized over the years, Sinead, that they may as well be artificial to bees and things like that. So we're looking for plants that are pollinator friendly. And a couple of very good examples that I can give you. One is one called Bacopa. Bacopa snowflake is a really lovely trailing one that it's very aptly named, because when it's in full flower, it looks like just dripping with snow out of the basket. Lovely white flowers. Mm. Another one that is very, very good for pollinators is a plant called Biden's Aurea. Lovely ferny foliage and really lovely kind of golden yellow flowers. And again, the bees and the hoverflies and all these important, important insects, they love it. And that'll also trail out the side of the basket and fill it up. It's kind of got a very informal growth habit. Then it's always good, I think, when you're doing a hanging basket and filling it with flour, it's good to kind of put in some foliage plants as a foil to soften the whole thing. So ivy is obviously a very nice one, a very good and important one as well. But there are others. There's one, it's a variegated Nepeta, which has this lovely minty smell, because, of course, it's related to the catmint Nepeta, another plant. But it's got a lovely variegation and the foliage really drips down off the hanging basket. And Lismachia, or Creeping Jenny, as a lot of people will know, is a lovely golden leafed one. You won't even see the yellow flower in it, but it does have a little yellow flower as well. These are great for trailing down, great for the pollinators, so good plants to use in the garden. But I would say, just keep an eye out. And, you know, I don't expect everyone to remember the plant names, but if you're in your local garden centre, ask them, is this a hybrid or is this a pollinator-friendly plant? Gardeners would be only too happy to talk to you, and if you're showing an interest, they'll show it back. And I would urge to go to the local independent garden centres, because they need to be supported, or else we'll just have, you know, the supermarkets and the sheds selling them, and you won't get the advice in places like that.
Sure, indeed. And actually, it's a great idea, I have found, to buy plants, the little bedding plants and plants that are already outdoors, because sometimes they can be hothoused, they're grown inside, and you bring them back to your own garden and, you know, they're not happy really at being moved about. So that's a great idea, because garden centres have that great outdoor area and, you know, they've been looked after. Now, when it comes to the perennial, the veg and the tomatoes, I am driven mad with the bugs. I planted for the first time some chili, and I thought it would fly up. The pictures and the thing were great, and it's been eaten to death. And anyway, it's something loves chilies. So that's gone. And then my tomatoes are growing, and I'm delighted to say they are growing, but something then loves the leaves of them. So how do we keep bugs off it without kind of throwing on poison pesticide, which we don't want because we're going to be eating this stuff later in the year?
I love chilies and I love tomatoes, but I haven't eaten yours, I promise. It's not me. But there are bugs out there. And as you say, we absolutely cannot put poisons on them when we're putting them on our plate. Even if we're not putting them on our plate, we can't be putting poisons out into the garden. But there are many ways. If you look backwards and look to the traditional ways of growing veg, companion planting were the main two words, Sinead, where they'd plant, for example, they plant garlic, which will deter aphids and caterpillars and things like this. It'll deter a lot of the pests like green fly, keep them away.
And vampires.
And plant them then next to the tomatoes and things like that, so that the tomatoes and that would be protected by the garlic. And you can go a step further with that now by making a garlic wash. You know, for anybody listening, just Google how to make a garlic wash, because there are different kind of strengths of it and different recipes. But in essence, what you're doing is you're getting the extract out of garlic and you're putting it onto the plants that you're trying to protect. And that makes the plants completely unpalatable. It can be edibles or ornamentals. Your tomatoes won't taste of garlic after this, don't worry, or your strawberries won't. You can drench it with this garlic wash, and it makes the plants totally unpalatable then to a lot of these bugs, the caterpillars, the green fly, the slugs, all of these things. And you see, whether we realize it or not, we need these, the nasties, if we want to call them that, we need them in the garden, because they're all part of the natural balance. You know, they're the diet for the birds and for hedgehogs and other animals in the garden. So we don't want to eliminate them. We just want to keep them off our plants.
Oh, that's a great idea. So garlic, a garlic wash. So pugs don't like garlic. So I'm delighted with that advice. I'll be giving it a go. Now, finally, can you give us a few tips, Peter, on herbs? They're so easy to grow. And I really believe everybody should have even just one pot with a few herbs growing, because the difference in taste is extraordinary when you pop them in a salad or add them to a dish or whatever. Now, I have come across one, though. Sometimes they can be a bit kind of aggressive. I planted like a peppermint in a pot where I had sage, and my goodness, it just ate the whole thing, strangled it to death. And I've had to take it all out of the pot. So some of them are kind of vicious in the nature world, and then other ones can be left alone. Give us an idea of what we can plant together and ones that we should just leave on their own.
You're very diplomatic in your language, and saying that, you know, they can be a tiny bit aggressive. The peppermint is not. It's a thug of a plant. It's a bully. And it will, if you plant any of the mints in the garden, they'll just spread and spread and spread. Now, I love mint. I love it in the mojito as well as in the cooking. But I love it as a plant, and just to smell it and see the butterflies on it. But it does take over. It's very, very aggressive. Only grow it in a pot in a contained area on its own. But it's worth growing, because I do love fresh mint. But A good tip to give for all of the others, the vast majority of them can be grown outdoors in Ireland. I would say that, with the exception of basil, which you would need to grow inside. And the vast majority, again, will be perennial. So they'll come on year after year. There are a few exceptions, of course, like dill and coriander, which are annuals, and parsley, which is a biennial. So it's a 2-year plant. But all the rest will come on year after year. But my greatest tip is, think about where they're from, Sinead. Most of these herbs are native to Mediterranean regions. So that means they're getting baked in the sunshine, and they're growing in very free-draining soil, maybe grit or even sand. So whilst over here in Ireland, we can't give them necessarily the baking Mediterranean sunshine all the time, we can control what they're growing in. So grow herbs in a sunny aspect where they're getting as much sun as they can, and in a very free-draining soil, because they don't want to be waterlogged. The roots just won't tolerate it, and many of them will just rot. So give them a good sunny position and a very good free-draining soil. They don't need to be fed, nothing like that. And the other thing, of course, is just keep using them, keep harvesting them. Then you're pruning them, and they're getting stronger and stronger.
Indeed, yeah. And they are for eating. So it's lovely to see them all flying up. And I'm delighted to report that my strawberries came back out early this year. So that's another good salad staple. Peter Dowdall, thanks so much for joining us with all those fantastic tips, as always. What's up for you now in the next couple of weeks?
Oh, it's a busy time. It's the busiest time for us gardeners, I suppose, at the moment. And next on the agenda is the Mallow Home and Garden Show, which is one of Ireland's biggest horticultural and gardening shows. And that's on the 24th, 5th and 6th of May. And I'll be speaking at it each day of the event. But that's a show. I think it's 27 years on the go. Wow. Now. And it's going from strength to strength. The numbers are huge, and a fabulous, fabulous day. Perhaps we'll see you there, Sinead.
Maybe indeed you will. And listen, Peter, if anybody wants to see you and watch you speak, and I've done it myself, you're absolutely fantastic. You get your hands dirty, you bring in all the plants, then you can look that up and down in Mallow, and people will enjoy that. Peter, thanks a million.
A pleasure, Sinead. Thank you.
Now, there is a large villa about 40 kilometres north of Berlin for which authorities have been unable to find a buyer for decades. Recently, the property has been offered free of charge, and still no one has come forward. So what gives? Deborah Cole is Berlin correspondent with The Guardian and joins me now. Deborah, you're very welcome along to the home show. Tell us a little bit about the history of this dubious property.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Sinead. Yeah, so this was a property that was built in the late 1930s for Hitler's propaganda minister, Josef Goebbels. And he had quite a large family, and so spent a lot of time with them there. He also entertained some of the top Nazi brass. And it was also known to have been a little bit of a love nest, as Goebbels was quite the Lothario in his day. And so apparently he also used it to conduct secret affairs.
Gosh, there's a picture now I want to get out of my head. Now, what happened to the property then after the war?
So after the war, you know, it's in it was in communist East Germany. So the communist authorities used this kind of sprawling site that is both rather remote, but also fairly close to Berlin. Remote in the sense that it's kind of in this idyllic setting on a lake. And so it lent itself to things like there was a hospital that was built on the grounds. And then there was also the youth wing of the Communist Party established a sort of training center there for the youth of the nation. And then after German reunification in 1990, and specifically since the year 2000, the villa itself and the whole site kind of fell into disrepair, became a little bit of a site for kind of, you know, dark tourism, which is very much a thing in this region.
Mm. And what is the general sense then of the German people about this? I mean, nobody likes that idea of dark tourism. And I know when I did a tour of Berlin myself, the bunker where Hitler ended his days is now just underneath a very nondescript playground. And there's no signage, there's no arrows, there's no way of knowing it's there. And that was probably a very deliberate choice. So is it that there are just no Germans who want to be associated with this property?
Well, you raise an interesting point with Hitler's bunker, because that was true for decades, that it was unmarked. Everyone knew it was behind the Peking Duck Chinese restaurant out in the parking lot, at least Berliners did, but tourists did not. And there was always this fear in Germany that it would become sort of a pilgrimage site for the far right and things like that. And then the decision was made in 2006, right before the start of the World Cup that year that Germany was hosting, to put up a sign. And so Germany basically has a lot of these sort of toxic sites that it has to come to terms with one way or another. And one solution is total transparency, you know, and the other is the wrecking ball. Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of a debate as to, you know, what the best thing to do is. There's also a kind of difference in general between sites associated with victims of the Nazis. So, for example, former concentration camps, everyone acknowledges that they are essentially cemeteries and have to be maintained forever in order to keep those memories alive. But what do you do with the sites that are associated with the perpetrators? Mm. It's often complicated.
Now, of course, Goebbels he died with the war. So what kind of condition is, if it's been kind of more or less vacant since then or used for different purposes, describe it to us now, Deborah, what does it look like?
So it's actually funny. Good friends of mine have their kind of, you know, little weekend cottage, kind of a stone's throw away from it. And, you know, the site is very overgrown and it does attract a lot of, you know, people who have perhaps a morbid curiosity. You know, you have these floor to ceiling windows that allow people to peek in and let their imagination sort of run wild as to what it might have looked like back when Goebbels used it. So it does attract quite a lot of people. I would say, as far as I'm aware, it has not attracted, at least not en masse, members of the far right. But that is a little bit the fear around this idea of giving the property away. There are some who say it would be better to demolish this site, and particularly because they're afraid of people from the far right perhaps, you know, wanting to take it over and use it as a gathering site. And there are others who say that it's important for historical memory to keep it as is.
So what is the government offering now? Are they offering just to have anybody take it off their hands, or are there conditions around it? You can only do this, or you must do this, a bit like, say, a protected structure might be, or do they vet who might be interested in this?
I think given how much media attention there has been around this, they would certainly at this point have to vet it. I mean, as I said, Germany does have so many of these potentially toxic properties that not every one of them gets the same kind of scrutiny, but perhaps because it's close to Berlin. And now, that it's kind of gone through the certainly the German press and also the international press. I think all eyes are kind of on this one. And so, yeah, there would be a closer look taken. Also, the community of Wandlitz, which is where the site is, they have, you know, suggested, for example, establishing a center for the promotion of democracy or do, you know, kind of other historically sensitive projects, you know, launch them in this site. But of course, the question there is, where do you find the money, you know, for them? So. Indeed.
Now, the Goebbels family had another luxury home on an island, and that was sold in 2011. Do we know anything about the process there or who the buyer was?
I know that it was sold at auction, and I don't want to say anything wrong, but I think since then it really has gone quiet around that sale. Okay. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you do have so many sites. You know, there was also a hunting lodge that belonged to Göring that was, you know, outside town of, you know, there was the home that Adolf Hitler, you know, his birth home in Austria. There was a whole kind of controversy around that, and they decided, I believe, to make it into a police station, if that was the final decision on it. So, you know, you're always dealing with this dark legacy, and the best way to integrate these places into contemporary Germany, which is very conscious of its historical responsibilities in general.
Okay, Deborah. And then finally, do we know what will happen if a buyer isn't forthcoming? Have they put a timeline on this?
I mean, at some point they've got to make a decision because the building is falling apart and because Berlin continues to invest a certain amount of money in security and basic maintenance of the site. So at some point, you know, Berlin is going to pull the plug. And so they are really putting pressure on, you know, for a decision to be made. But I don't know if it's the same situation in Ireland, but things that involve many layers of bureaucracy take forever here.
For sure. All right, Deborah, thank you very much for joining us on that. That was Deborah Cole, Berlin correspondent with The Guardian on the Goebbels house. Now, my next guest started in business at the tender age of 12, selling games on eBay, and then he found a door and a skip, and today has 30 employees and a turnover of 2 million a year. Joseph Holman is CEO and founder of Green Doors and joins me now. Joseph, you're very welcome along to the home show.
Hiya.
Now, tell me a little bit about how you got started in Green Doors.
So both my parents had very poor upbringings. They drilled into me that money was limited. So when I had this in my mind, I was always looking for an option to start, you know, my entrepreneurial journey. And at the age of 12, when I was out shopping with my parents in a toy shop, I came across some magnetic sticks and balls. It was like a game you make, and you can make different sculptures out of them. And obviously, I wanted to build the biggest sculpture I possibly could, just like they showed you in the stores. But I realized that the price to for each box was, you know, around £30. And that was, you know, you could only build a very small model with that. So obviously, without, you know, disappointedly, I went home and my dad allowed me to search on his eBay account for the same item. And I came across a seller who had around 500 boxes of these items, and they were selling them for just about £2 a box. So I couldn't believe it. I wanted to buy the whole lot because I could obviously see that there was going to be a big profit in these items. Obviously, I can see them in the shop for £30. So at £2, surely they must be worth more than that. But unfortunately, my parents only let me buy 200 boxes of them.
200.
Yeah. But yeah,
Did you manage to sell them for a profit, Joseph?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we put them on, advertised them on eBay for around £10 each to start with, and they were selling really well. And then in the run-up to Christmas, I was put the price up to £15 plus postage, and they were just flying out the door.
Wow!
But I made around £2,000 profit when I was 12. So
absolutely fantastic! You are clearly on the road to entrepreneurial success. So it was there from early age. Now, talk to me about finding the door in the skip and how that has led to your very successful business.
Okay. Well, obviously, when I was 12, I was kind of hooked on buying and selling stuff. And I started as a plumber when I was 19 years old, and I saw the amount of reusable items that they were chucking away. So they were just disposing of boilers that, you know, still worked, all the bathrooms they used to rip out. So I used to take all these items home, strip them all down, and then resell them on eBay. So I was making about £700 a month apprenticeship wage, and then £3,000 to £4,000 a month more my little side hustles.
Gosh.
Selling all the boiler parts and stuff like that. And it was one day when I was at a plumbing job that I noticed a set of French doors on a skip.
Yeah.
And obviously I just saw another opportunity there. I thought, you know, okay, well, I didn't really think much of it at the time. I just thought, okay, well, I'll take them home and see if I can resell them. So I took them home, cleaned them up that night, advertised them on eBay. And the next day, I'd already sold them for £320.
Wow. Okay. So these were French windows, but now green doors. And green is meant not just the colour green, but of course the green, the eco upcycling of doors. Your business spans all kinds of doors, front doors and sliding doors and French doors and all the kind of the posh ones now that you see in homes everywhere. So all the doors then, do you find them yourself? Are they donated by people, or do you, you know, are you going out and taking them from manufacturers, or how does it work currently?
Yeah, so we obviously after finding those doors in the skip, I didn't know I'd even start a door company at this stage. So I was just, you know, searching around trying to find as many doors and windows as I could. And I realized the amount of waste in this industry was, you know, tremendous. I definitely wasn't short of stock. I then visited a window and door company one evening, and I saw they had a mountain full of doors destined for landfill. So that's when I had my kind of eureka moment that I wanted to, this was my chance to set up a company doing this, because I could just see how big it could become.
And pre-owned doors, I mean, do people get rid of them just because they're doing up a house, or are manufacturers getting rid of them because maybe they've ordered the wrong thing or they're the wrong size? Is that where most of them come from?
Yeah, I mean, we buy them off all the installers or all the fabricators of all the companies. So we buy all the ex-showroom items, we buy all the mismeasured stock. And obviously all the pre-owned items as well. So as you can imagine, every item that's made in a factory is, you know, majority of the time it's replacing a previous one. And obviously that's where we come in, where we purchase, you know, the older items and resell them. I mean, these items should have about a 35-year life expectancy for a UPVC door. Mm. And some of them, if they're mismeasured, they don't even make it out. They're brand new. They don't even make it out of the factory before they're on the way to landfill.
Extraordinary. So. And now there's so much business in this now that you've had to rent a massive warehouse to store all the stuff and have staff then to do the buying and selling on your behalf. So who are your customers then? I presume they're the very same people. They're just, you know, at a different stage in their project. And is sizing an issue?
Yeah, there's obviously been many. I've got dyslexia and ADHD. So when I saw, I could see the vision of this company, but I didn't know how to get there. I thought it would be very easy, but obviously there's many problems along the way. One of them being the size of the items, because we basically work the opposite way to a manufacturer. They'll bespoke make an item to size for you, and obviously we've got the items already in stock, so we're just trying to find the right people for the particular size. There's been many challenges along the way like that.
So it's like a Tinder for doors, matching the person who has the hole in the wall with the correct door to fit in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you spoke there, Joseph, of your neurodiversity. And does that mean that you have this fabulously creative process? As you say, you can vision it. And have you then found it helpful to surround yourself with people who can do the stuff maybe that you're not, that you don't enjoy as much?
Yeah, I have, yeah. It's taken a long time to build the team that we've got, to be honest. And it's obviously, it's quite a niche business. So it's been difficult getting the right people on board for the right job roles. But now after 10 years in the business, we definitely got the right people in the right departments. I'm not very good on stuff like numbers and figures and stuff like that. So finally got a really good accountant on board.
Fantastic. And of course, it means then that by recycling doors back into the economy, back into people's houses, you're reducing manufacturing and transport costs, reusing materials, which of course is such a big thing right now and so important. And do you find then that people, are enjoying that message? Maybe it provides a story for them. Look, my front door came from here and it was formerly in a big Georgian house or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it was obviously not most people come to us to save money, but I can see the world is changing. There's more and more people are now coming us to the sustainability side of things as they weren't 10 years ago. So that is obviously definitely shifting.
All right, great, fantastic. And listen, where can people find out more about the company, Joseph?
Just visit us online at greendoors.co.uk.
Fantastic. Well, Joseph Holman, CEO and founder of Green Doors, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Now, Jennifer Sheehan is with us in studio and she has brought with her tips and trends from the Interiors Trade Show, Salon de Mobile in Milan. Jennifer, you're very welcome back to The Home Show.
Delighted to be here.
On News Talk here. Tell me what kind of things were on show. Now, this is a trade event.
Yeah,
so it's
a trade event.
Things maybe that are coming down the line that will eventually make an appearance. What's on and what's working. And what kind of things did you find?
So much. So it's a trade event, you're right. So it's open, it runs from a Monday to a Sunday. And it's open to the trade from Monday to Friday. But actually, unlike most other trade events that happen around the globe, the public can go in on the Saturday and Sunday. So if you're listening and you think that sounds interesting and you love the idea of strolling around, you know, exhibition hall after exhibition hall full of beautiful furniture and home furnishings and everything else, so big that you need a bus to get from one end to the other, then, you know, feel free to pop along at the weekend. It is open to the public. It's been going since the 60s. It's a huge, huge, huge event. Mm. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the size of 7 or 8 RDSs.
Wow.
To the brim.
Okay.
And the other thing that's really attractive about this event in particular, as opposed to other trade shows that go on, is that what has sprung out at the fringe of Salone del Mobile, which is the original trade show, is Fore Salone. So this is a huge citywide, you know, pockets and streets full of other events that have sprung up as part of Salone del Mobile. So that is all the kind of newer, slightly more eccentric, artistic, up and coming, innovative designers and established designers who might put their more kind of out there stuff on. So it's all over. You can just
sounds like Edinburgh Fringe for interiors.
It is a bit. Some of the stuff's kind of mad, but it's really, really great. So the great thing is you're seeing, you know, the best and the newest and the coolest of what's coming down the line and what we can expect. A lot of what tends to be on show at trade shows is for hospitality because that's where the money is, right? But the best of that then makes its way into our homes. And so it's great to see it. So what I saw a lot of was very heartening. Sustainability is huge still, huge. And it's only getting bigger. And it's, you know, it's gone from being something that people used to talk about as a bit of a tick box really into the core.
Mainstream, yeah. And people come looking for it. And I suppose this is driven by customers who are coming in saying, what's the provenance? Where did it come from? What's it made with? Mm-hmm. And how long can I keep it?
Yeah.
And that idea of having something that isn't plastic from China that's going to be gone next year is really important for people in terms of products that are being made.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there was a good bit of that. That's great.
Yeah, brilliant. And what that really grows into then is a lot of organic materials, you know, so local wood, stone, whatever it might be. And that then has given rise to a lot of organic shapes. So lots of curves and knobbly edges and all that kind of stuff. And so that's really nice to see. It's much more interesting than the
straight
line.
Because I suppose when something isn't perfect, but it is a natural source, it can actually look much nicer.
Yeah.
You know, if you see something that should look different in the wild and suddenly it's been honed and hewed and within an inch of its life and it doesn't look like itself anymore.
Yeah.
And there's something nice about seeing, you know, the way you'd see a piece of driftwood as some furniture or something. It's lovely like that. Okay. Now, in terms of patterns and colour and things like that,
so much colour.
No peach fuzz now. I'm not mad about this year's Pantone.
It's pretty big. It's pretty big.
Is it?
Yeah, it is out there. Yeah.
I'm still blaming Barbie for that. I don't care. Right. Okay, so the peach fuzz, right?
The peach
or as we used to call it, kind of beige.
The beige. Peach is big. Pat, colours are still massive. Colours aren't going anywhere. And while there are a lot of lovely neutrals, and for example, boucle isn't going anywhere, colours are huge. A lot of that really vibrant colour is back as well. So
great.
Kind of newly
pop, like colour pops.
Colour pops.
Okay.
I saw fluorescent colours, which I don't like too much neon. I find it quite tacky. But a tiny pop of neon or fluorescence here and there. Do you ever see, you know, the beautiful glass Tooth watches? They're a very beautiful, very refined, very gorgeous German brand, but they just have one tiny second hand in a fluorescent colour on some of their models. And I love that. I think that looks really cool.
But for the rest of it, for furniture, you're looking at the magic marker kind of look, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, it has been hugely popular, even in kind of high street shops as they are with these kind of perspex chairs.
Yeah.
You know,
that
kind of,
nice.
And it can look very, very nice in that. But I don't know that I want a kind of a day-glow orange cushion on my sofa, you know?
Or paint. What I've seen is people just paint, for example, the inside of the door. So not, what would you call it? The part that is closed when the door is closed, the frame, kind of around the frame of the door. So that only when you're opening and closing the door, you just see the splash or the inside of drawers. So that when you pull the drawer open, you get this cool splash of colour. I think it can look really nice, but I would pare it way back. I like a tiny, tiny pop of it every now and then.
And also some people like the idea of maybe a neon sign, you know, one that you can plug in that says family or love or whatever. Are they a bit passé now, are they?
I think they're still big, and I saw a lot of them. They're not personally for me, but I think, you know, a lot of people, that's only a personal choice.
Like the idea of it.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Fantastic.
Exactly.
Now, sinks. We do love a sink on the home show, and I'm delighted to see that they're a little bit funky.
Yeah.
And what's coming is much more interesting than, you know, the white porcelain.
There were so many cool sinks. It's one thing, I think, these days, there's no excuse. Don't bother buying a plain white sink. There's no need. There's so many amazing sinks out there. There's only cooler, bigger, better, brighter, more dramatic ones coming down the line. I saw the most beautiful terrazzo sinks. So anyone who looks at my Instagram, I'm at Workers Cottage, you'll see I love terrazzo. I have a huge, my whole bathroom almost downstairs is done in terrazzo. The most beautiful, cool, you know, talk about a wow statement piece is a gorgeous terrazzo sink. I saw lots of different shapes. So these would be kind of concrete cast sinks in, you know, hexagon shapes, wavy shapes, shell shapes, all the coolest shapes I could find. There was a 3D printed sink, which was really cool. So that was ceramic, original ceramic, but had the most inviting kind of wave form, almost an under the sea ripple effect. It really wants you to touch it.
And you can have great old fun if your sink is freestanding. It's just attached to the wall and have something that's a bit wow. Brilliant.
So if you're shopping, have a look on Etsy.
Yeah.
There's lots of amazing, really cool sinks available on Etsy for not that much money. So have a look.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, of course, metal has always been around in the home, and it forms parts of radiators and sinks and kitchen counters and all that kind of thing. I'm not a huge fan of it, but you are.
Well,
or did you find that the Italians
changed my mind? Oh. I wouldn't have been in the past. I find it a little bit cold, and that whole industrial look, I really appreciate it, but it's again not personally for me. I don't like it in my house. I like kind of soft colours and all that. What I saw this year a lot of, and I think it was back to that sustainability theme, because this will last you forever and is fully recyclable, is stainless steel metal kitchens, but painted.
Ah.
So coloured.
Okay.
And what I really loved about these is, one, they're slimline, so they're really shape, you know, they have a lovely shape. They're not too bulky. They're really nice in a small kitchen. But number two, what I saw from a couple of designers was the colour extending from the panels, from the kitchen, you know, doors and all that kind of stuff, over to the countertop. And because the countertop is made of metal, it's reinforced and you can, you know, it's not going to scratch. It's not going to stain.
Okay.
Some of them were covered with like a reinforced glass. But I thought that was cool. It was colour drenching in your kitchen. Next so, level colour drenching.
Yeah, so the sink is no longer aluminium or steel. It kind of is forms part of the, like a basin of the colour of the whatever the counter is.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I thought that was
lovely.
Kind
of get on board with that because there's something very hardy about metal and it, God knows, it lasts forever.
Yeah.
So it's a good idea to have it, but it hasn't always looked nice.
Well, I don't love that those stainless steel kitchens are not personally...
They're
commercial. They're kind,
they
are.
They look like a hotel kitchen or a restaurant kitchen, and nobody wants that at home. Okay, so that's a way of having the metal without kind of it looking like it.
Yeah.
All right. So what's your favourite piece then, Jenny, that you saw in Salone? What is the one thing that you'd say, wow, if that comes to a shop near me, I'm going to get it?
One thing that I loved, I have to say, was statement pieces and sculptural chairs in particular. Mm. So I saw lots and lots and lots and lots of these really cool, very out there, very creative shapes when it comes to chairs. And I just think one or two of those dotted in your house could transform everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
So get yourself a statement chair.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, listen, that's the Salone trade show exhibition in Milan. And you can pop along to that if you happen to be in that part of the world during April. Jenny, thank you so much for doing that trip on our behalf.
You're very welcome anytime.
So on your own behalf. And I hope you didn't need a second mortgage when you came home, did you? No,
you're not having... the Aperols that I picked up along the way. I have a wish list. I have a very long wish list after that, I'll tell you that.
I'd say it's longer after a few Aperols. Right, okay. Well, listen, you're very good to come in and tell us all about it. And thanks a million. And Jenny mentioned her Instagram page there, which is at Workers Cottage, where she posts absolutely fabulous stuff. So you can have a look at that.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan
with Mila.
Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.